This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
One conversation, I ended up crying. You're on a payphone, maybe you're kneeling, you know, on sharp gravel, because I'm tall and payphones they're stuck down at child's height. And at one of these goddamn food and gas places, and you're trying to get some farmer's attention who's in the next state. And this one guy said, well, I garden organically. He says, I'm a farmer, but I don't know about these Indians. He said, you know, America's a Christian country. And it's in the Constitution. It's written right in there. I don't think I want to participate. That one kind of fried me.
Hello, welcome. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller.
From our studio in Sebastopol, California. And this is a show about journeys.
Today, two stories about peace and war, the process of making.
You may recall that we ourselves are kind of incorrigible peaceniks. And so we do like to give equal time to more rational beings, the voice of the majority. So to start with, here's our friends Walt and Patty in a suburb of Santa Rosa. It's breakfast time, and Walt hasn't been sleeping well.
What?
No, I didn't say anything. I grunted.
You're just not sleeping very well, are you?
You know, I'm sleeping. I'm not resting. Can I have some more coffee? You know, maybe I'm not drinking enough coffee. If you sleep too deeply, your unconscious comes up with really freaky stuff, you know, sort of alternate realities. What's that?
The neighbors. Maybe you're watching the news too much. I mean, it's kind of constant.
Well, we got to stay informed. I mean, we got to know what's coming at us. I mean, these are dangerous times. We were on a trip in Europe or something.
When?
When? In my dream.
Oh, this was your dream.
I know. Oh, coffee, yeah. Okay, so Europe, yeah. I mean, we had a hard time finding a newspaper. I mean a real newspaper, American newspaper. And so finally, I'm reading the newspaper, and there's this big government report that we are not strong enough. I mean, and this was bipartisan. I mean, even the Democrats admitted they'd been totally wrong. You know, we have all these enormous weapons, but they're too big. We've got thousands and thousands and thousands of thermonuclear weapons, chemicals, biological neurotoxins, but we're a sitting duck. Good coffee.
Yeah, this is that organic coffee where they give people a living wage.
Yeah, so we're in this foreign country, this kind of cafe bar kind of thing in the morning. Everybody is kind of staring at us like, they're getting the message, you know, and they're going up to the bar and getting these little cups of espresso, and they know that I can't do a thing because of the nuclear test ban treaty. My hands are tied.
Your hands?
I'm the president.
Walt?
In the dream. So it kind of shifts, and then the cafe is in the Oval Office. So what we're planning then is very tiny H-bombs. This is for little countries. There are all these tiny little countries that swarms them like ants. They always vote against us at the UN, and they're ganging up like germs in germ warfare. I mean, is it really? And we have no defense. Like, they could run right between our legs.
Well, dreams are symbolic.
And then the people in the bar start chuckling. They look at us, and they look at each other, and they look back to us. You were sitting there. You were kind of frozen stiff, really kind of ridiculous. Like, and so we're going to have these little tiny bombs that'll, you know, wham, take out a mountain. And these people are giggling.
In the dream.
But there's the question of proportion. You know, how do we handle this? So we're going to have all these little tiny tanks and armored personnel carriers and neurotoxin botulisms and kind of little spray bottles. And that makes sense, you know, in the car. But we look around and people are laughing. And then we think about model airplanes, only they're not models. They're airplanes for these little bombs.
What?
And by this time, I mean, you know, people are absolutely howling, you know, because how do you put your army in proportion? Yeah, you could do midgets, but there's not enough midgets. So we have to use 5-year-olds.
Dreams are very strange.
Well, I mean, you already see little kids killing each other. I mean, it's a natural instinct. It just kind of gives them a constructive outlet. But then I look up and nobody's laughing. Nobody's laughing at us. They're just drinking their coffee. I woke up.
What happened to the test ban treaty?
Well, it's a dream. I mean, there isn't an actual test ban treaty. In reality, I mean, I don't think there is. I mean, it's kind of a general feeling that you shouldn't do it if you don't have to. I mean, take precautions. Look, it's a dream. And we're only going to use them if we have to. Hey, can we check out the news for a minute? I'd kind of like to find out what's going on.
Walt.
Patty, am I sounding strange?
We were listening to Alternate Realities, one of the series.
That was Bomblets.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
Well, who in fact are the peacemakers? Some would say the diplomats, the grim-faced ones. Some would say the protesters in the streets, or political activists working on the next election or the next Senate vote. Some might say people working in communities or factories or the fields to eliminate poverty and racism and the causes of war or the wars that happen in families.
But what about bearing witness? It's a religious concept. My action may have no direct effect, but it simply bears witness to what I believe in, a silent vigil. People spelling out peace with their bodies, pouring blood on the weapons of war, praying on the steps of the Capitol. Is there a point to that? I don't know.
This is the story of a journey of witness. A very, very long trip. Some would say to no effect. You decide.
Steve Fowler grew up in Northern California, went to drama school, married, and after various moves and changes, learned horticulture, designing gardens, and that's what he's done all his life.
In 87, when my wife died of breast cancer, I began sort of really pursuing my bliss. And so what I gravitated to were park-like jobs where there was a volunteer element. And I found the Burbank Farm. I'd been working as a volunteer to get the project on its feet for years, and then finally they hired me as a gardener in 1989. And the other thing I did was I discovered a group who were starting a project in Sebastopol, Regal Park, called the Peace Site. And also the founder, a guy named Arthur Lish, who is an anthroposophist and a visionary. And I love it, and it's a sweet spot. And there is a constituency in the community that appreciates it. 10%, maybe 15%. Nationwide, I think, there's a constituency that wants there to be places, monuments for peace. So I'm part of the peace garden movement, you might say. But in 89, Arthur, he's always sending people off on quests. And he said, Steve, there's a group starting a fundraising design program for a national peace garden. I mean, this is going to be the real deal in Washington, D.C. I designed a very feminine peace garden. It was based on the idea that soil, good soil, is the foundation of the human community and also of our ability to survive. Therefore, it is the universal solvent among all people. And so that a peace garden should consist of a collection of these soils from all over the world. So my hill consisted of the best soils from the best bioregions of the entire world, shipped in there a few yards at a time, heaped up into a giant ring, and then hollowed out in the center, and there was a plaza with water. It had a spiral, it had this sort of volcano, it was all grassy. And then you approached it on a flagstone path that had the word for peace inscribed in every third stepping stone in their language, in a stone from their country. Anyway, they didn't like my plan. There were 930 competitors. And they sent me a notice and, announced the winner, who was then rejected by the Art Commission of Washington. They had to go back to step one. This is all by way of introducing what Arthur was suggesting next, which was that I go around the country and collect the best American soils and bring them to a spot that he thought was the perfect spot for a national peace garden. Now, I'm going to tell you about the site. It's a little fire hydrant of a monument about 300 feet from the Washington Memorial. It's called the Jefferson Pier. It was placed by Thomas Jefferson But it's on a spot that was at a totally crucial spot, according to the original plan of Washington. And you have to understand that L'Enfant, Pierre L'Enfant, who designed Washington, was definitely a Pythagorean cat. I mean, he put this right-angled triangle right at the heart of things. The Capitol building on the east end, go exactly due west a certain number of paces, and you come to this junction point, make a hard right, 90 degrees, and go another number of paces, and you come to the president's house. And then you draw a line from the president's house to the Congress, and that's Pennsylvania Avenue. So you have a perfect right-angle triangle. But he felt that the Congress and the president had to be balanced. And this triangle represented that balance point. And Jefferson put this little pier there. Well, it was supposed to be the site of the Washington Monument, but Congress wouldn't fork over $200,000 for an equestrian statue. And so it went on and on and on. And finally, the Masons came up with the final design, a 555.5-foot high tower of solid block granite, the tallest masonry structure in the world, a giant phallus, in short. But it couldn't be put at that point because the ground was marshy there. This thing weighed so much it had to go on this hill over to the right. As a result, the entire monumental scheme of Washington was skewed, and it was skewed in favor of the executive. That monument was finished in the late 1800s, so it's been over 100 years. In fact, Jefferson had said, I want a new meridian in America. I don't want to depend on the Greenwich mean that England, because we don't want anything to do with England and that old corrupt culture in Europe. We want our own meridian. It'll be right through the president's house and right through this point. Well, that's another story. Didn't happen. So I want to read you something Jefferson said. Those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God, if ever he had a chosen people, whose breasts he has made his peculiar deposit for substantial and genuine virtue. Jefferson, in short, was a farmer, and he had a vision of America as small farmers, well-educated. So it made perfect sense to go around the United States and visit all the small farmers I could find and take soil from their farms to Washington and create a ring of soil around the Jefferson Pier, thus realizing my idea of a peace site. You know, I wanted to get the Peace Garden people over there for the ceremony and say, look, this is powerful, see? This is soil. This is a ring. It creates its own energy right here. We might get some politicians. At the very least, I thought we'd get a little press and we could influence the debate about sustainable agriculture. So I just I bought a little trailer. I got a camper for my truck. I got in my car, and I was pulling a little trailer that was full of 5-gallon buckets, all different colors. You know, eventually when I got there, but my thing was that I would just crawl in there at night. I mean, I had a mattress on the floor, and it was full of books and tapes and maps and food that people had given me. And then I'd just sit on the tailgate and eat my meal. I was pretty Spartan, you know. It's a diesel, so it cruised along. I got pretty good mileage. Okay, well, you know, the short story is that 8,000 miles later, I had collected 39 soils. I'd been in 20 states, and I had had the most amazing adventure of a lifetime. And I'd done it all alone. It was always phoning the next farmer. It was all, read a list, get a name in that area, and I'd call somebody up, and they'd say, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm going to be at the farmer's market this weekend, but you might try, you know, Joe. So I'd call Joe, and Joe would be there, but he's like 100 miles out of the way, you know. And I had some visual aids. I had a picture of my peace garden, which I called a ring of world soils. And then I had a sign on my truck that said a ring of American soils. And one wag said, oh, he says, I've got a ring of American soils on my bathtub every night after I empty the water out. You know, little by little, I saw the dark side of American agriculture because I would encounter these guys. I first of all, go to the small towns in the Midwest. They're ghost towns, virtually ghost towns. They're small-time businessmen getting a 3% cut of the agricultural dollar, whereas Archer Daniel Midland is making 20% on their investment. The poor farmer has to buy the tractor from a subsidiary of Archer Daniels Midlands, no doubt, buy his seed, which has now been genetically engineered by another subsidiary, go to the bank, which is another subsidiary, to get his funding. Then he has to buy the fertilizer and the pesticides, which is another subsidiary of this octopus. And then when he sells his crop, he's selling it to the same octopus. So they know to within a dollar what that guy's going to make. And they give him just enough to make it worth his while to plant next year. And then they take that stuff and they waste it. And that's American agriculture. So I got to Moab and I saw this southwestern landscape and these huge pink rock faces. And I just started to feel like I was getting where I needed to go. And I met a guy in Moab and he said, okay, go to Moncopi Village. That's the first Hopi village. And he said, you'll see the farms there. And then I get to Moncopi Village, and I drive through this neat little neighborhood of stone houses and on a little bluff. Get down to the bottom of the hill. Right away, there's a guy on my tail. And I get out of my car. Nice Indian man. And I realize all of a sudden that virtually every premise of my trip was meaningless to this man. The peace movement, sustainable agriculture, the National Peace Garden, what did it mean to him, you know? And I felt like my trailer said intruder on the side. And suddenly I thought, whoa, what do I have to, you know, what can I ask this man? So I said, well, look, here's what I'm doing, and I'd just like to take 5 gallons of soil from your village garden, and I'll take it to Washington, and I'm going to try to do some peace work with it. So he said, well, you've got to talk to the governor, Sir Robert Sakyestewa. His house is up there. It's getting to be dark, you know. So I go up to talk to Robert. He's not there. And the neighbor says, well, you know, this is typical Indian stuff. He might be back tomorrow. Maybe not, you know. His brother may be back, but I don't know. Maybe not. So I sleep in this rotten motel parking lot. Don't sleep at all. And all night I'm thinking, this is it. This is the acid test of my journey, my vision. If it doesn't make sense to these people, and they're the true Americans, then what the hell am I doing? They have gardened here 800 years. They gotta be about as sustainable as anybody can get. And that's what this is all about. So next day I go back. The house seems deserted. I got out of the truck. I started drawing a Cretan labyrinth in the dust. I got about halfway through and this guy walked up. He said, oh, he says, I'm Albert Sakyestewa, Robert's brother. And I said, how do you do? I said, you know, and I'm squatting in the soil, I'm practically on my knees. I said, do you know why I'm here? He said, yeah, come on, let's go. And we went down the hill, we got dirt. He showed me his garden, we had a wonderful talk. And away I went. And then it got darker, it got darker, it got darker in Texas. I went up to Washington and down to Arizona, then over through Texas, up to Wisconsin, down to Georgia, and back up. So it was like a huge zigzag. And eventually we did our ceremony right on schedule with these soils. And when I got there to Washington, there was just a couple guys there, my collaborators, Arthur and Chuck, and they had a permit, but the permit was for a one-day display at the Jefferson Pier, and it forbade the scattering of any soil there. See, here's what I've discovered about peace work. I discovered that you do it for yourself. It's something that you have to do. If you're really, really angry at the government, and you go down to the Peace Garden and you start digging the soil, at least you're doing something. You're turning a shovel full of dirt over. And what happens is that something closes in you. A circuit is closed. And you feel whole because you have made a step. And 90% of peace work is that. It's just people reaffirming for themselves that this is what they believe. This is the way they want the world to be. And I just had to go a lot farther. I had to do all this other stuff, drive all those miles. And I discovered, you know, I discovered the dark part of myself. There I am hurtling through the night, you know, in a big diesel, burning up gas, cursing the oil companies. And eventually I got the irony of that. And then I got sick. I had bronchial infections, and I'd be lying in some, you know, miserable godforsaken RV park in the middle of nowhere. And that's a good time for self-reflection, seeing what, you know, what's really motivating you. What's going to make you get up tomorrow and keep going? I mean, I kind of grew up. One of the reasons I did it was that I had fallen in love and I had a broken heart, and because I'd been spurned after 6 months by this lady who was inappropriately young, and you know, so on, you know. So so I was driving along with a broken heart too, and so I was really having to grow up, but I didn't know until I got to Washington that Arthur would be there. I knew that. If I got there, that it would be complete. And I knew I was going to put those pots around the pier. I don't care if they hauled me off to jail. I was going to put them there. And in fact, I even thought hauling off to jail wouldn't be such a bad conclusion. Might make more news. And in fact, it would have, because nobody came. Not a single congressperson showed up. Not the National Peace Garden people, even though they knew we were in town, didn't come over to say hello. No newspaper wrote any article about it. So what we created was 12 hours of interesting distraction for tourists who happened to stroll by on one day in Washington. But the fact is that if you think about it in the invisible world again, there is a presence there at the Jefferson Pier that endures and is sustained. The West is the visionary part of any land. And we've taken the vision from the West, and we've reintroduced it there. And I'm attending. I want to go ahead with my plan, which is that eventually all the soil, all the great soils of the world, the great agricultural soils, will be brought to Washington, and will be scattered somewhere or built into that ring, because I believe in it. I do. And I'm willing now to put my body and my money, my everything, where my heart is. We live in a time when people have to actualize their own dreams. We're in the process of making a myth, putting together some kind of myth that will sustain the race in the face of what I consider to be psychotic behavior by our leaders. There's an old war between those people and the sustainers, the people who keep it all together, the nurses, the farmers. But I think we're writing a new myth. Now, I think, if you want to know my personal opinion, that the Earth is not stupid. She's completely intelligent. She's been able to regulate her atmosphere for 3.5 billion years through all kinds of exigencies. I'm a gardener. Living things produce seeds sooner or later. The Earth is a living thing. Therefore, she will produce offspring. The offspring has to be sent out into space. So when you have very advanced metallurgy and ceramics and cybernetics, you can do that. Now, I don't think the Earth is doing this by accident. I don't think it's an accident at all. How could it be? How could it be that the great crescendo of all this industrialization is this push toward space? Where'd that urge come from? But meanwhile, what we're doing in the peace movement is we're saying we're just kind of holding the mother's hand, you know. It's going to be all right, dear. Now we'll take care of, you know, we'll take care of this, we'll take care of that for you. You know, we're going to try to keep the rivers clean and the air clean, and everything's going to be okay. Now just hang on, you know, because this is a cataclysmic birth process that the Earth is going through. That's what I think.
In Sebastopol, we were talking with Steve Fowler. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
And Steve asks that, okay, if you go to Washington, D.C., go to the mall, and here's what you do. There's a parking lot near the Washington Monument. Walk due south, and slightly to the right of the Washington Monument, you'll come across this little granite fire plug with some trampled dirt around it and an illegible legend chiseled into it. Due south, you'll see the Jefferson Memorial across a lake. Turn around, you'll see the White House. You're exactly on the line that Thomas Jefferson wanted to be the meridian of the New World. And hopefully, Steve said, someone in the White House will get the news from Jefferson what a democracy really means in terms of taking care of the land you've been given in community, and we'll have a culture again.
Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by the Independent Eye with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts and from the Hitchhikers Guild, which you can join by visiting our website, www.independenteye.org. We need your help to continue this broadcast ministry, so put one hand on your radio, the other on your checkbook, unless you're driving.
This is Elizabeth Fuller.
And Conrad Bishop. Peace and joy.
This is Dalen Lee Jones from Indiana. And what she alerted me to was the fact that the songbirds have virtually disappeared from the middle of our country. And it's a curious fact, but since plants evolved with birds, some of them don't even open their stomata, that is, their breathing apparatus, unless they hear birdsong. So the plants somehow sense the birds and respond, oh, it's spring. They're nesting. Now it's time for me to do this or that. They know what's going on.